Do any of you with kids ever read Zits? It's my all-time favorite cartoon. So this was from a couple of years ago, and you couldn't read it when I took a picture of it. But I thought with tonight's discussion on emptiness, it kind of fits well. So I included it. So welcome. Do we have anybody here for the first time? I didn't think so. Okay. All right. It has happened where the last class, it's somebody's first, and then they just have to come back and pick up from the beginning the next time. So, and I can't believe this really is our last class. So that's good. And we've covered a lot, and we're going to cover even more tonight very quickly and briefly, but we're going to talk about some other key concepts in Buddhism. So last week we, let me go down to, well, let's go and do meditation since that came up. We'll do that instead. So let's go ahead, and all of you kind of know the posture that you're comfortable in. You can practice the 7-point posture if you'd like. And for those who haven't tried sitting on the cushion, if you'd like to, now's your chance to come sit on a cushion for a few minutes while we do a quick meditation. And just take a few deep breaths. Just settle your thoughts from the busyness of the day. And as you take your deep breaths, just try to relax, let go of tension, or at least just recognize it. Recognize where you feel tension and discomfort in your body. Notice body sensations or in your mind. And sometimes just labeling them. Can they lose their power, their significance? So you could say, ah, there's my anger. Ah, yep, I was frustrated. Ah, there's that back pain. Just label and move on. And let's do the 9-round breathing meditation tonight, because we're going to need our energy and alertness as we get through some of these topics this evening. And if you recall, we have thousands of energy channels throughout our body. We have 3 main channels. You have a central channel, and then you have a left channel and a right channel. And in Eastern philosophy, the channels can become blocked, and that's a cause of low energy, physical disease, mental disease, etc. In a 9-round breathing meditation, is said to unblock those channels and allow energy to flow freely. So we'll start with our right ring finger, and we'll plug our right nostril. We'll breathe in, then we'll let go, plug the left nostril, and breathe out through the right. We'll do that 3 times, and then you plug your left nostril, breathe in through your right, and then you let go and breathe out through your left, plugging. And then you take 3 through both nostrils. And then as you exhale through both nostrils, that would be for the 9-round. We'll do that 3 times too. And the idea is really think. Picture the air going in. I'm blocking those channels. You're letting go of any negative energy, taking in lots of positive energy. And that way we'll get rid of obstructions. So let's begin. Ring finger, just block your right nostril and breathe in through your left. And then block your left and breathe out through your right. Two more times. And now block your left nostril and breathe in through your right. And exhale through your left. Two more times. And then breathe in through both. And just imagine that you've cleared these channels from obstructions. You're increasing the energy flow. And just set your intentions for being here this evening. You stuck this out. It's a huge commitment. 5 times. On weeknights, after work, after school. Yet you came. So rejoice in that. And then set your intentions. And as you set your intentions, remember to think about your own well-being and happiness. And then expand that to the well-being and happiness of those you're close to, those around you, throughout the area. And then just keep expanding that outside of these walls, community, and everywhere in the world. Last week, we covered a lot. We reviewed the topics in some detail. We talked about precious human rebirth. We're going to do a little Buddhist prayer tonight that gets at that preciousness of human rebirth. We talked about the Buddhist view of death, the principal aspects of the path. If you recall, there's 3, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness. And then we talked about a few key terms. We talked about compassion, loving kindness, equanimity. And we also reviewed the 6 perfections. We talked about generosity, morality, patience, joyful effort, concentration, and wisdom. That wisdom word again. So this evening, we're going to focus on the 3rd aspect of the path, the wisdom of emptiness, and then related topics, which are impermanence and dependent arising. And we'll talk about those not in much detail, but we'll cover the basics. And then we're going to talk about the scope of the Lam Rim path, and I'll start with that. And then we'll talk a little bit about what it means to be a Buddhist, you know, what is Buddhism, and some Buddhist prayers and what prayer means in a Buddhist tradition. I'm happy to answer any questions throughout, and then I'll try to remember to stop and ask if there's any questions. And If you ask me any questions I can't answer again tonight, I'll have to take your emails, and then I'm happy to get back with you. Email, phone number, whatever you want to give me, and then I'll give you an answer. So did anything bubble up for you on the topics that we covered last week? Well, I have an answer about the earlobes. I don't know if you recall, why is Buddha's ears so... And Mike's not here tonight. Mike said he thought it was because Buddha was a prince. And I said I thought it was an auspicious sign. So I found my notes that said the long earlobes were an auspicious sign, that it kind of depicted the great compassion of Buddha, in that he could, you know, hear the suffering of the people, and that increased his compassion. And that's what they represented. And then I looked online, the great wisdom of Wikipedia, and it said it was because he was a prince. although it also said, or it could be compassion, you know, that he could hear the suffering of the world, but it said that in that day and time, it was probably because he was a prince, because if you were wealthy, you wore jewelry to show your wealth. And so they wore plugs. Literally, they wore clay plugs. And that, since Siddhartha was a prince, he wore plugs. And then when he became, you know, he went through the 6 years where he sacrificed everything, the plugs came out, but the earlobes were elongated. So I didn't see Geshe-la, so I asked two of our nuns, Tendrin-la and Kandala, and Tendrin responded and said she never received the ear teaching. But when she looked up information, it's because he was a prince, and princes were prince whatever. The plural of prince wore jewelry. I like my story better, and so I'm sticking with it. But the truth is, you know, wealthy people in those days and times wore jewelry. Yes, hang on a second. Mr. Microphone's coming.
Okay, so last week we were talking about that humans are the only sentient beings that can act with intention, right?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm not going to like this.
So I don't quite understand, you know, if a perfect human rebirth is considered very rare, it doesn't seem to me like some non-sentient animal that's not working with intention. I mean, he's just having happen to him what's happening to him. So how does that play into the idea of rebirth?
Thank you. And that's actually a great question. And it does happen, right? Animals do, whether they act with intention, I don't know, but it seems like it, and they do good things. It happens all the time. You see mother birds feeding baby birds, but they kill worms to feed the baby birds. So there's a lot of, I mean, they're creating a lot of negative karma, but animals do create positive karma. I mean, they have a long way to go to get up literally the food chain to where they have our human brain, that they can observe their thoughts, that they can change their brain to act in a more positive way instead of negative. That's a human quality. But animals all the time do good things. And pets are probably the closest to getting a human rebirth than animals living in the wild, right? Because, you know, unless, you know, our cat catches a mouse in the house or bats around a roach or gets outside and kills something, which she has done, most indoor pets don't kill for their food. So they, you know, they're less likely to create more negative karma, and they do a lot of positive things, you know, when they're in the house.
But isn't that just putting human thoughts and emotions on animals? I mean, they might not think the same thing.
No, and they don't, right? They don't think, oh, I'm doing good. And unfortunately, we shouldn't think that way either, but we do, right? We think, oh, I just did a good thing. We probably blow all the good karma we got when we do that. But they do act with intention. I mean, there was just a story on Facebook, so I know it was true, about the dog. There were two dogs. Anybody read that? And the one fell in the hole or whatever, fell, and the other dog would not leave it. and would try to find help and bark and stuff, but kept coming back, wouldn't leave the dog. And they were there for days. Anyhow, I mean, there's all kinds of good stories like that. Good stories of, you know, gorillas in the wild taking in a completely different animal species and raising it as their own. And so they do create incredible karma that they probably come back as a human quickly, if not in the next life. You got anything to add to that, Pastor Chris, David? Sound all right? Good question. I tell you, I've learned a lot in this class. Thank you. Okay. So, before we start, I do want to do the equanimity meditation. I'm going to use the Kathleen McDonald book. We'll do it quick because it really does, it will help tonight the way we think, how we label, and what that kind of means. And so this is the meditation on equanimity. And we'll do it quickly so that we don't take a lot of time. But it's a nice meditation. So go ahead and get comfortable. And focus your attention inward again. And just take some deep breaths. And set the intention that we're going to do this meditation in order to develop perfect equanimity for the benefit of yourselves and others. Now I want you to imagine in the space in front of you three people. Someone you like, someone you dislike, and someone you feel indifferent to. And retain the images of the friend, the enemy, and the stranger throughout the meditation. So first, focus your mind on your friend and ask yourself why you like this person. You might think, well, they're nice. They're nice to me. They're a good person. And see if you can recognize that your reasons are mainly because of what she or he does for you. Are those good reasons for liking someone and holding them dear? Then look at the person you dislike and examine your reasons for feeling that way. Did they harm you? Were they mean? Again, check if your ego is involved. For example, the person may have harmed you or may have behaved in ways that you find unacceptable. Are those good reasons for totally disliking someone and treating them badly or wishing them harm? And then look at the person you feel indifferent to. Why do you feel this way? Can you just see if your ego is involved here as well? Is it because this person has neither helped nor harmed you? Now ask yourself if you regard these relationships as permanent. Do you believe that you will always get along with your friend? That you will never get along with your enemy? And that you will always be distant from the stranger? And recall relationships you had in the past that changed. A friend becoming an enemy or a stranger or vice versa. And just imagine the friend in front of you doing something hurtful or unacceptable. Would your feelings toward this person change? Recall that this person was not your friend before you became acquainted and could very easily cease to be your friend in the future. Realize there's no sound reason for feeling kind and loving toward only the friend of this moment. Relationships changed in the past and will continue to change. Today's friend can become tomorrow's enemy. Turn your attention to your enemy and imagine this person doing something kind or helpful, maybe praising you for something you did, helping you fix your car which is broken down. Look carefully at your feelings. Are they softening? You can learn to feel warmly towards your enemy. This has happened before and will happen again. Why hold so strongly to the conception that this person is definitely enemy? And what of the stranger? The relationship could go either way. The stranger could do something helpful, such as giving you right directions when you're lost, returning your wallet which you dropped absentmindedly. How would this affect your feelings towards this person? And then in the Buddhist tradition, we would think about past lives and what we could have done to that friend, enemy, stranger that we now label them such in this life. But whether or not you believe in the idea of past lives, you understand that relationships aren't permanent. You've seen that in your life today. It can be really helpful to recognize in some ways everyone is equal, exactly the same. Everyone wants to be happy, does not want problems or pain. Another way we want to be equal is that we all have the potential to free our minds from all negativities, develop ourselves to the fullest, and achieve ultimate clarity and compassion. Everyone can and will become enlightened one day. Just try to recognize the differences we see in people are superficial based on our mistaken and narrow self-centered viewpoint. If our thoughts and feelings were more in line with reality, we would see that everyone equally deserves our care and compassion. Just one analytical meditation that's in Kathleen McDonald's book. I mentioned it before. You can tape this. You can listen to it so that you can really just sit and meditate on it and not read. And lots of good things that you can do with meditations you like or a topic that you really just want to sit with and contemplate on. Okay. Ready? So we talked about the three aspects of the Lam Rim. So now we're going to talk about the three scopes of the Lam Rim. And I had mentioned it's three volumes, one for each scope, written by Lama Tsongkhapa in the late 1300s, early 1400s. And it's considered the interpretation of all the Buddhist teachings, and he just did it in this lovely meditative fashion, and it's considered the graduated path to enlightenment. It's just this gradual steps that we can take, that will take most of us eons to be able to do, but the the goal is just to keep practicing these. And just think of the scopes as different reasons for practice or a different purpose for what we're practicing for. So even though they're different levels, they almost stair step on each other, and we use them all. And it's not necessarily linear. You go from one to the other to the other. They're just different practices, different ways that we keep trying to influence our mind and our thinking. So the first scope is called the modest scope, and the focus is on getting a positive rebirth. And we should all be thinking about that. We want to have a good human rebirth in our next lives. We want to generate good karma now. We want to try to stop, you know, creating any negative karma or, you know, doing non-virtuous actions. Venerable Rubino, he says, if you could just zip it up, if we could just zip up our lips and do nothing else, we'd be better off. But if we could zip up our mouths and do something good, whoa, and then we're creating great merit to hopefully have another good human rebirth that we can keep practicing. So that's the focus there. Don't want to lower rebirths, because then we're going to long way to go to come back up. Then you have the middle scope, which is focused on liberation from suffering. It's renunciation. You get it. And you want out. You don't even want a positive human rebirth. You just don't want to come back anymore. So you want to do whatever it takes, you know, good karma, eliminating negative karma, but what you need to do to achieve enlightenment or nirvana. You know, you don't want to come back again, go through Groundhog Day over and over again until you finally achieve enlightenment. You're ready to go. And then the last is the greater scope, and this is that the Mahayana view, where you're focusing on enlightenment, not just for yourself, but the primary reason for focusing on enlightenment is you want to help all beings that are suffering to eliminate their suffering. And it just makes sense that you would go that step beyond, because then how could you, when you're enlightened, you'll know the suffering is there. Like, how could you truly be calm and peaceful and in nirvana knowing you've left, you know, all the rest of us down here to suffer. And so the idea is to change that. We do a lot of wellness and safety work, but I just heard this great story that Desmond Tutu was touring a bunch of journalists, and I forget where they were in Africa, but every time the journalists, you know, he'd come up to somebody, he would say, well, how are you? And they would say, we be fine, or we are fine. And then the journalist pulled Desmond Tutu aside and said, what's with the we? And Desmond Tutu said, oh, how could they be well if their family's not well or their neighbor's not well? You know, in other communities, they get that interconnectedness, that interdependence on everybody. And so we don't want anybody to suffer. So the whole goal of the greater scope is to, you know, relates to bodhicitta. We realize we want others to be happy and not suffer. Each scope, it's not necessarily better than the other. Like I said, they just all build on each other. And each one's just a different focus, a different puzzle, a different way to just look at it. But all three are absolutely integral. One's not, they use the term greater, but one's not necessarily less or greater than the other. Those are just terms that are used, okay? So we talked about the three aspects of the path. We talked about ignorance before as one of the main root causes of our suffering. And it's the wisdom of emptiness that was, you know, renunciation, bodhicitta, the wisdom of emptiness, and that's what we're going to talk about now. And they discuss it like two wings of a bird, that you need both. You need to have compassion and build the compassion, and then you have the second wing is wisdom. You need to understand how things really exist, the wisdom of emptiness, and it takes both of those to become enlightened. And, you know, Geshe-la always says, it's like somebody will do something, they'll say, compassion without wisdom. Because many people are compassionate and we try to help, but we don't have the wisdom to really know what to do or how we should do it. And so you have to cultivate both aspects in this tradition. So wisdom is described by most as a really difficult topic and something to really hard to get your arms around. Now, intellectually, as soon as I start talking about this, you all are going to say, oh, yeah, of course. But we don't act like that. On a day-to-day basis, what we're going to talk about tonight is not the way we see things or the way we usually act. So intellectually, we might be able to spew it out. But to realize it and to really experience it takes eons of really practicing and really trying to cultivate that wisdom. Venerable Rabina actually said for her, understanding wisdom is far easier than achieving compassion. And she says, and for many people that is true. So wisdom has a definite connotation in the West, and it doesn't mean that we're all brilliant. In Buddhism, it means the absence of inherent existence. The absence of inherent existence. That true or inherent existence, we don't exist like we think we do. So we see this concrete, independent object or person of who we are. And there is no such thing as that concrete, independent person. We instinctively project that true inherent self. And we project the existence of table, cushion, water bottle, everything we see. We project it as being inherently independent, existent, on its own. Yet all phenomena are completely dependent on causes and conditions. There is no phenomenon, none, that isn't dependent on causes and conditions. You can kind of understand it when you think about a fruit tree. You have to have a seed, you plant it, the seed had to come from another tree, you have to water it, you have to have all these causes and conditions to get this seed to grow. And it's true of everything. And intellectually we know this, but it's really not how we see it or act. And this ignorance is considered to be the root of all suffering, that when we look out, we see this concrete, inherently existing world that really is just the world we see ourselves. And it's not the same world that I'm seeing right now that you all are seeing right now. It's really different for all of us. And so through the Buddhist teachings and through all the teachings that we have here, you know, we're all trying to learn and trying to realize, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean to us? And there are helpful examples just to show that if phenomenon had an inherently independent existence that weren't dependent on anything else, we would all see everything exactly the same and they would never change. They would be completely concrete, separate, and unchanging. They would be permanent. And so just, you know, there's lots of examples, but just think of it, for example, with food. How many in here like beets? How many in here love beets? How many? I see all these hands go up. How many in here do not like beets? Maybe just despise beets. Thank you. Just two of us? Oh, okay, good. If there was an inherent goodness or badness in a beet, how could we all see that differently? Or, you know, you could think about black licorice, like, you know, people love or hate black licorice. So we project a deliciousness or a yuckiness factor on that, and we see that as true. Like, I look at a beet, and I'm just repulsed. I just can't even watch somebody eat a beet. So that's my own projection on that beet, and there's nothing inherent about that beet that makes it delicious or yucky. And if you think about a food you love, chocolate cake, and if chocolate cake's not your thing, Geshe loves his cheesecake. He uses cheesecake all the time. So whatever food you love, we project that deliciousness onto that food. I mean, as soon as we see it, we immediately, one, we label it as chocolate cake, and we immediately think it's delicious or yucky. It's just immediate. We don't even see that the two are separate. It's that quick. But how much chocolate cake could you eat before you're just, you know, your mouth hurts and it tingles and you kind of lose any good taste from that? You know, it happens pretty quickly. You could, you know, I was going to say you couldn't eat a whole cake, but I've probably tried. But truly, you couldn't eat that much cake. Sooner or later, the deliciousness is gone and it's going to have a gross factor. So on that level, it kind of makes sense. Nothing exists independent of, you know, causes and conditions. Nothing exists inherently, independently, concretely on its own. Now, it does not mean nihilism, which means that nothing exists. Just that, you know, anything made up of components does not exist on its own. So it's not, you know, you don't have these two extremes. It's not a nothingness and it's not the concreteness. Yes.
Any connection with Solipsism or
Solipsism? Oh, sorry. My fault. Thank you.
Does it have any connection with Solipsism or Sophism?
I don't know. What are those words? Say it again.
Okay, there's Solipsism, and then it goes Sophism, then it goes Existentialism, and then it goes to Nihilism. And they usually, like, it's just different views of the world, I guess.
Okay. Okay, Chris is shaking his head no, and I'm not familiar. I think it's different. I mean, nihilism would be the same definition. Do you want to add anything to it?
Well, I don't know exactly what the word means, but I don't think it's like that.
Okay.
Yeah, emptiness just is. It's not... It doesn't
dependent.
Come from it. It's not a thing, so it doesn't come from something else. So, and that, anyway.
That's a good way to explain it. That's good. Now, they might, you know, you see lots of similar terminologies, and, you know, there's, you know, existentialism, you see here nihilism, there's lots of different beliefs. And this tradition doesn't negate those, but it doesn't discuss them. I mean, it's just not part of it. Probably doesn't give you a good enough answer, but I think that was good, that emptiness is separate from all of that and exists on its own. Okay.
Maybe if you read that definition different, you could say nothing truly exists instead of nothing truly exists.
Okay. I like the way you said that. Nothing truly exists. Does that sound better? I like that.
Well, meaning that there truly is a nothing. It truly exists, as opposed to it doesn't exist.
What were you going to say, Chris?
No, I don't want to say anything.
No, go.
Maybe it's just been pounded in my head so long, I've got a completely different... Yeah, that might be, you could say that, you know, nothing does truly exist. You know, nothingness as, well, again.
Yeah.
Nothingness is not a thing, yeah.
Nothing that, yeah.
And emptiness is not a thing either.
That's right.
It's like a condition, it's not
even. Yeah, we'll just leave it as.
So is this similar to the belief in other philosophies that the world is an illusion, like it's Maya?
That the world...
is an illusion.
Oh, we're going to talk about illusion and hallucination, yes. And we're going to talk about that in a second. Yes. it is very similar to seeing the world as an illusion, a magic trick, a dream-like quality, and I'll read you some stuff too. Yes.
But what about physical things like the chair I'm sitting on?
We're going to talk about that here in a second. Good question.
Yeah, the chair.
It's
the chair
there.
The chair is there, but it doesn't exist as you think it does.
Just not the way we think.
Right.
So I'm going to use an example of a car. I'm going to say, I don't know if it's next, but it is. So this joke sits on our refrigerator. It's kind of yellow and worn and torn because it's probably been there for 8 or 9 years. So does the chair, does the cushion, does the car exist? If we were all in our right mind, I mean, I could say, no, that's not a cushion, that's a bed. But most people, you know, of sound mind would say, well, that's a meditation cushion, and we could all agree, or that's a chair, or this is a table. We could agree what a car is. But if I asked you, where is the car? Like, can you point to it? Can you point to the carness of a car? Is it the wheels? Is it the bumper? Is it the steel? Is it the paint? Is it how it functions? Where is the carness of those parts? And when did it become a car? And when will it no longer be a car? Like, what would it take to take it apart that it would no longer be a car? So there is a base, right? On a conventional level, we have a base that we can all agree what it is. And then we project labels. So if I showed you a picture of a car, we would all agree, well, yeah, that's a car. We could all agree maybe on the color, probably not. Some would say silver, some would say gray, some would say light gray, whatever. We might not even agree on that. But we would agree on most things. So we labeled that a car. As soon as we saw the picture, we learned it as a child. Child points to an object and we teach it words and we say car. And then immediately, every time we see a car, we say car. As a kid, we probably got it wrong more than right. Then once you get it right, that label's immediate. Okay? The thing is all contaminated phenomenon, all phenomenon are dependent on causes and conditions. And they change moment to moment. And we'll talk about that just a little bit. We see things as pretty solid, and as none of us can look around and see things changing before our eyes. I shouldn't say none of us, because some of you may be a Buddha and you may be able to see things changing before your eyes, but I can't. I look at these walls and, you know, they're walls. And it's not until something's crumbling or there's a hole in them, it would have to be disintegrating before I would be able to see that change. We do that with our bodies, and yet we know, and let me just say, it's not just our bodies, even the wall, every solid thing in here is giving off carbon atoms, is giving off things, we're taking it in, we're giving off stuff constantly, just from a quantum physics perspective. Our bodies, we know for a fact, are not what we think they are. Our skin cells are sloughing constantly. We have more bacteria in our gut than we have living cells anywhere else. And those bacteria are constantly changing. Our red blood cells, how often do we get new red blood cells? Like every 72 hours or something? How long is it?
Every 2 months?
Every 3 months. So in 3 months, we're a completely new person. we don't know it. We don't feel it. I just listened to something on NPR, and before I came in here, I meant to look it up, but they were talking about that we have our own microbiome that is surrounding us right now. It's like, they use the example, it's like pig pen. We have this, everybody remembers the pig pen character? We have this whole cloud around us that's all of our slothings, and that when we leave this room, we actually have the equipment that a scientist can come in here and measure and say, yep, this is where Karen sat, this is where she walked, and be able to differentiate me, my microbiomes from anybody else's. So we're not even just sitting here, we're slothing all over the place. So if everybody could keep their microbiomes to themselves, but, you know, we don't exist like we think we do. And on a scientific level, science is catching up with Buddhism, but we know it's there. So, you know, we cling to this self. We cling to self-cherishing. We cling to the shiny new object, you know, wanting a new car, that we know. You know, it's that ignorance that causes that attachment and that aversion. We know it's not going to make us happy. The next gadget's not going to make us happy. We might think that, no, we don't have a lot of self-cherishing. You know, we cherish others. We think of ourselves as smart, kind, good, whatever. We have all kinds of labels for ourselves. But what if somebody challenged that? What if somebody came up and said, you're just one of the nastiest people I have ever met, and watch what happens to your self-cherishing ego then. It's in rare form. You know, the how dare you, and, you know, I'm a nice person and you're not. I mean, you know, the whole, it would just come out immediately. We would go to defend that. And in the Buddhist tradition, it's that ignorance, that hallucination of this concrete self, a yours and mine, a real existence out there that causes us to, you know, this attachment, this aversion, this clinging, and that's what leads to all of our suffering. It's there, and it's really just an hallucination. It's just an illusion. And it's, you know, that label of self is considered the granddaddy of all.
Is there ownership in Buddhism?
Is there ownership? Tell me more what you mean about that. Oh, like if you own something?
Do you actually own something then, if you believe that there's this sort of interdependence and...
Oh, yeah. I'll let you ask. You can ask it in the microphone.
So the question was, is there ownership, or at least a different concept of ownership within Buddhism? Do you truly own something, or can you, if you view things as impermanent or interdependent, is there a Buddhist philosophy about ownership? I mean, if something really isn't something as we see it, can we actually own that?
That's probably on a deeper philosophical level. Do we own anything? I don't know that I've heard anything about that in Buddhism specifically. I mean, we do own things, and like I borrowed a pen from somebody, and I said I'm going to borrow this pen, but I'll bring it back.
Well, see, so you don't own that.
So I don't own it, but I never did. But if somebody tried to take a pen that I did own, I would feel a strong sense of ownership. So I don't think there's anything inherent with Buddhism in that. But I think it's a deeper philosophical question, too. I mean, you know, we say mine, but, you know, what is ours? And yes. Want the mic.
I don't think there is ownership. The whole goal is to recognize that we really don't own anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember a story about Lama Zopa, that something about glasses, and one of y'all might remember where he said, you know, these are just glasses that he's wearing for a while. They're not his. They just belonged, you know, he just had them temporarily. And I thought that kind of goes along with the whole renunciation concept too, but I may be wrong about that. Sets of robes. I mean, to let go of that attachment, there's the concept that we own something, but you can't take anything with you, right? At the end of the life, you own nothing. It's just temporary kind of hanging on to it. Watch that too. I'll do this in a grocery store, pick up something, and you know, pick up an apple. And I don't like that one. I don't like this one. Now I pick it up and put it in my cart. Now it's mine, right? It's all of a sudden.
It's like that story I shared about His Holiness's watch. It's that same thing.
Yeah. You just label it. You label things mine and ownership, but you really don't own anything.
Right. So it's by karma.
What was that?
Karma.
Oh, yeah, you own karma. You do own your karma. That's good. Thank you.
That may not be right, but that's my understanding.
So the other concept is impermanence, that all phenomenon is changing moment by moment. Phenomenon is changing, as we said. But we don't really see it as changing. So I have this favorite cup that I don't know how old it is now. It's got to be 25 or 30 years old, that was this beautiful rainbow that you can barely see colors, and it's so scratched and discolored now, and the rainbow's gone. And so every morning, well, not every morning, if it's in the dishwasher, I can't drink out of it. But whenever I drink out of it, I just think, this still is my favorite cup. The beautiful rainbow is now fading. It's just a good reminder. Everything will fade, and sooner or later, I'm going to drop and break this. So I'm going to enjoy it every day I can, but it is not going to last forever, and it will break. I bring it here whenever I'm teaching this, and I always think, well, tonight could be the night I'm going to drop it out in the parking lot at the center. And I thought, well, that would be kind of fitting way for this to break. And then, you know, you can ask yourself, where is the cup in this cup? You know, where does the cup exist in this cup, or the colors or anything? It is empty of any cupness that is part of this cup. And there's lots of things you can do to show yourself the impermanence. The exercise on equanimity is a perfect way to think about impermanence, because you all have people who were your friends and you now label as enemy. And you probably have enemies that did something nice and became your friends. It's just a label that we put on these things. They're dependent on other causes and conditions. They're not permanent. There's nothing inherently existing in those, you know, in those objects, in those phenomenon, or in our friends. So it's the same kind of thing. So when you look at the definitions, I'm going to just move ahead. So there's three other concepts that are really closely linked to this idea of emptiness. So one is interdependence, which we use that term, and we kind of understand interconnectedness, that we're all dependent on others. We wouldn't be here without a mom and a dad. Our kids wouldn't be here without that. I mean, we all kind of get that pretty easily. And then impermanence is that moment-to-moment things and events that come into existence disintegrate. As soon as they come into existence, they start to disintegrate. We just can't see that happen, but it's already begun. And then the term is dependent arising, that yourself and all things, all phenomenon. And when I say phenomenon, it's those with form and without form, but all phenomenon come into existence in dependence on causes and conditions. They're parts. And the mind labeling them. And that's everything we experience. And, you know, they use the analogy of, you know, it's like a magic trick, that if you were shown a magic trick, we would kind of be amazed and we'd believe it. You know, we'd be trying to figure out how it happened. But that's not true for the magician. He knows it was a trick. And once he shows you that trick, or she shows you that trick, then you no longer you no longer see it as real. You know, you see it as that magic trick. And so we can see it there, and so it's a matter of seeing everything as that illusion, that magic trick. And there are people that practice that every day, you know, when they're walking, and they'll just say, you know, who is it that's walking? Or they'll, you know, see whatever, you know, comes into their view, and they'll see it as an illusion or a dream. You know, they just keep telling, you know, just bringing back that dreamlike quality. And there's a prayer that we say in a couple of different, you know, a couple of different times, but it's just all environments and beings like magicians, illusions, dreams, and the moon reflected in water are empty of inherent existence. Though not truly existent, appearances designated by names and thoughts appear like bubbles coming forth in water. And, you know, a reflection of the moon, like animals see reflections. Geshla was just talking about this last Wednesday, where, you know, you see a reflection and an animal thinks it's real, where, you know, we get that that's just a reflection. And so if we could see everything as a reflection, that would just be, you know, that should be our goal. On a conventional level, does that chair exist that you're sitting on? Yes. You know, it exists conventionally, and we would all agree with on that, but it just doesn't exist like we think it does. It is dependent on causes and conditions, and it's dependent on parts being in certain orders. If the chair was sticking out of, you know, the legs were sticking out of the back of that chair, it wouldn't really function that well. We probably wouldn't label it as a chair. If we had wheels and a steering wheel and some rubber and some metal thrown in a pile, we probably wouldn't call it a car, even though it had all the parts of a car. And if I was the one putting that together, it definitely wouldn't be a car. Like that wouldn't happen. And so we depend on the parts being in a certain way, in a certain position, you know, as we do look at that. And then we learn the label, and it goes from there. Other questions on emptiness? Yes.
Well, it would seem to me that you exist in a world in which you have to be aware of the things that are in the world. But on a second level, a kind of non-duality, you have to be aware of the emptiness. But to get to the permanence thing, instead of looking at everything being impermanent, why isn't it a series of moments of permanence that change?
Permanence would be something that wouldn't change, right? It would be permanent. And because nothing is permanent.
At that time, like, you see this, and then you see this. It's like taking a series of photographs.
Gotcha.
For example. Bad example, but, you know, so yes, things change, but at that one moment, all those things were in existence. And at the next moment, other things are in existence, but at that one moment, that's what you got.
Go ahead, I'll let you answer.
There, I don't mean to keep...
I was reading about this the other day. When you start dividing a moment down, though,
oh, yeah.
there's a moment. I mean, there's the start of the moment and the end of the moment, and there's the middle part of the moment, and then, you know, then you can take those subsections and keep dividing them down and down. So you really don't get to a moment where anything is permanent.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when they discovered, what was the God particle, Bose something? Geshla said, well, it still has a north, south, east, and west. You know, so his point was, there's always going to be another subparticle or a smaller particle.
I think scientifically they said that too. Well, that wasn't the God particle. There's something else. Okay. There's books out there. There's a whole discovering Buddhism on, it's 5 or 6 weeks long, just on emptiness, that goes into a lot of detail, even though that still just skims the surface. So it's one of those things you just keep working and wrestling with. So we talked about what is Buddhism, and we talked about that it's going inward, that somebody who's Buddhist goes inward, and the counselors and the psychologists that are in here would say that this is true, that if you think this is bad, you should see the inside of my head, and that it really is a good indication what's out there is probably what's inside. And so when you go in, the whole idea is that you know, you're looking for, you know, what makes you happy, where suffering is, what the true nature of life is, et cetera, that we spend time looking at. We also, a Buddhist means that you go for refuge. We use that term, go for refuge to the Buddha and the gurus, the Sangha, which is the community, and the Dharma, which is the Buddhist teaching, and that you accept those, and they're called the triple jewel, or the three gems, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We talked about Buddha being the enlightened mind, and you know, the whole idea is that you choose, this is what you're going to refuge in, rather than TV or shopping or food or alcohol or drugs or, you know, or another religious type of belief, that you go for refuge in the three jewels. It also means that you accept, at least in hypothesis, the four seals or tenets, and one is impermanence, that everything is constantly changing. The other is, the emptiness, the things don't exist as we think they do. That, and that all phenomenon are by nature suffering. And then the last one is nirvana, is peace. You accept those and study and learn more about them. And then we talked about this too a couple of times. It's based on conviction, that you're not just taking somebody else's word, that you're studying and you're learning and you're trying to figure this out for yourself, as if you're buying a diamond or a piece of gold, and what you would do, how you would take that apart to make sure it was really a diamond, and or it was really, you know, solid gold before you would buy it and make it your own. Questions, thoughts about that? So do we pray in Buddhism? And yeah, but it's not really what you traditionally think of prayer, although I don't know if that's true. You know, it's really a wish or an aspiration is what the prayer is. And so, you know, it could be to help you meditate on a topic that you're, especially when you say mantras, or, you know, it's just a way to really think about a certain topic. Maybe it's to help you through a difficult time, to help calm your mind, and you know, you try things, you try it and you see, does it work for you? You know, how does that feel for you? It can be an aspiration where you want to, you know, change your thinking to more positive thinking. It could be that you're trying to get to your true Buddha nature and really trying to, you know, find that and nurture that. It could be that you're just praying that you can have the qualities of a Buddha. And it doesn't, even if you don't follow in this tradition, prayers can do the same thing, and you don't have to think about the qualities of a Buddha. There's lots of wonderful qualities out there in all kinds of different faiths or non-faiths, but you can look at, you know, Pope Francis or Saint Francis, or you can look at Mother Teresa or Martin Luther King. I mean, there's lots of examples of, you know, people that have great qualities that we could aspire to be like, and should. Questions about prayer. So we have several lovely prayers that we say on a regular basis. And for those who may have come on Sundays or to some other teaching, some of these are probably familiar to you. The one that we say often is called the Four Immeasurables. And this is just the wish for all to have happiness and be free from suffering. And so may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness, and that's love. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering, and that's compassion. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And that's considered to be the greatest love, the greatest compassion. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies, which is that sense of equanimity. The lovely quick prayer that we could say often. And then there's a prayer for the precious human life that we have, that they often say if we said this every day and we reminded ourselves, it would be the antidote for depression and lack of self-compassion. But every day, think as you wake up, today I am fortunate to have woken up. I am alive. I have a precious human life. And I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to use all my energies to develop myself, to expand my heart out to others, to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I'm going to have kind thoughts toward others. I'm not going to get angry or think badly about others. I'm going to benefit others as much as I can. And, you know, just to say that every day when you're in the shower or wherever, just to set that intentions for the day. And sometimes I have to put a qualifier on it and say for the next minute that I'm going to not do some of this stuff. And you can do that, right? You know, we can put time limits that we're really going to try. And for some things that are harder for us to do, then you shorten that time down. At least wait until I get out of the shower before I have one negative thought, And then, you know, we talked about the Lam Rim and the three volumes, and there's a 14-stanza prayer. It's called the Foundation of All Good Qualities that, you know, Geshe-la says we should all memorize in, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, because it, then you can, as you memorize this, you can quickly go through and it really hits on every scope of the Lam Rim, you know, that the modest scope, the middle scope, and then the greater scope. And I'm not going to read the whole 14 stanzas. But you can download this from the FPMT website, which I'll give you in a second. And it used to be on our website, and I looked at the Buddhism in a Nutshell page, and I didn't see it there. So I just need to spend more time looking, because I'm pretty sure it's on there, or it's on the Kadampa Center website somewhere. Because I swear I downloaded it a couple years ago for somebody. But so this is the brief Lam Rim outline. It's called the Foundation of All Good Qualities. And the Foundation of All Good Qualities is the kind and venerable guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely on him with great respect. So we see the guru, and then that, you know, we're going to refuge in the three gems. That's what we're really going to try to achieve and rely on that with the greatest of respect. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once, is greatly meaningful, and is difficult to find again. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly, day and night, takes its essence. So it gets is that precious human rebirth that we've talked about. This life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like a shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. You own it. And it's coming with you. It's the only thing that's coming with you when you die. And then finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me always to be careful to abandon even the slightest negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. And actually, there's one in between those two. So this was stanza 1, 2, 3, and 5 that you got. But it really does give you the idea of, and, you know, going through that outline, you're hitting almost all the topics that we've even covered in here. Yes.
So how long do these prayers go back to? When were they written? What language that they were written?
You know, in our prayer book, it tells you who made the interpretation of the prayer, but how long do they go back?
This one was from...
That one's the Lama Rim, yeah.
Lama Tsongkhapa.
Yeah, that goes back centuries.
Yeah.
But about the first one.
1497 to 1419, so...
Yeah.
This one was written in Tibetan, but Tibetan was developed out of Sanskrit to in order to bring the Dharma from India to Tibet. So Sanskrit.
But about the first one,
the precious human life is His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
And what about this one?
The four
immeasurables. I don't know how old that is.
I don't know what there's different versions of that, so I'm not sure.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just a general question, kind of as it relates to compassion and karma and some other teachings. Are a lot of Buddhists vegans?
It's a good question. Yes and no. There are Buddhists who are vegans, but it's not a requirement of Buddhism. It's not part of Buddhism, not veganism or vegetarianism. It's not. His Holiness eats meat. I mean, depending on what country you're from, you do eat meat. I don't remember if I told the story. Somebody asked Venerable Rabina that, because Venerable Rabina eats chicken. I don't know if she eats other meat, but I know she eats some. But somebody asked a question about why aren't Buddhists vegetarians? If you know, sentient beings and the sacredness, and then she said a couple things. But one thing she said was, you know, like some people don't eat meat, but they'll eat fish. And she said, you know, if you eat shrimp, how many shrimp do you have to put on your plate rather than just one cow? And how many people does a cow feed? But you've killed all those shrimp instead of one cow. And then she said, if you're vegetarian or you're organic farming, I mean, you may do organic farming for lots of different reasons, but from a Buddhist perspective, with any farming, if you spray, then you're killing insects with your pesticides, right? So even if you only eat vegetables, from a Buddhist perspective, you've killed to eat those. And if you do organic farming, it's like the worst, because you've hired ladybugs or whatever you've just purchased to eat whatever aphids or anything else you have in your garden to kill them. So no matter which we espouse to, we're in samsara, we're in cyclic existence. So, you know, she looked at it from, don't think we're all so high and mighty because we don't eat meat or we don't eat fish or we only eat organic. We're not as high and mighty as, that was the point she was trying to make. But it's just it's a different way to look at it. It's a different thing to kind of wrap your head around.
Okay.
So it's a personal choice for many, but not because it's required to be a Buddhist that you have to make that personal choice. That's a good question. Thank you. Any others? Yes.
Don't you think the intention of what you're eating and why you're eating it comes into play?
Oh, the intentions of what you're eating and why you're eating it come into play. Yes. And not only, I think that's a really good thing. And even if when we ate our food, if we thought about all the people who toiled to bring it to our table, and I mean, if we just thought about all that goes into our eating and where our food comes from would be huge. And if you eat your food out of, you know, respect, and, you know, I take fish oil for, you know, for heart and my cholesterol, and I have to, you know, whatever. When you take something like that, I just, every time I take it, I just think, you know, how many fish gave up their lives so I could take this one tablespoon and gulp it down. And, you know, so you do bring your intentions in that, just the respect that comes with that. You know, they say if you kill your own food, like, that can be the worst, but there's hunters who kill to feed homeless, you know, who kill deer or whatever to feed homeless. I mean, you can't judge any behavior. You truly can't, because you don't know anybody's intentions, right?
On an unrelated topic, what religion was the Buddha before he thought about his, you know, four wonderful things? Like, was he a Hindu? He lived in India. There's a lot of similarities that I can hear.
He was a Hindu, and actually there was some great Hindu priest or somebody who predicted that Siddhartha would probably be, you know, would probably want to be this great religious person or go off into that kind of a missionary thing. And, man, that's what his father was adamant would not happen. But it was in that Hindu faith. I mean, just like Jesus was a Jew. Yeah.
From what I learned as a kid, partly that was the reason Buddha was kept in seclusion.
That's right.
He was told that he would renounce everything.
That's right.
He was kept hidden from all the Islam.
Yeah, his father didn't want him to see any suffering. He thought, oh man, you're rich. We're going to keep you safe here. You're going to take over my kingdom. And so that he would not, and, you know, which he did anyhow. Yes, sir.
Karen, as I heard the story, it was that the sage at the time of his birth said that Siddhartha would be either a great king or a great religious leader.
Yeah.
That was what, and his father wanted him to be
a great king.
A great king. And that was why he raised him in the palace, or he didn't leave the palace until he was somewhat older.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Sage, that was the word I couldn't think of. So there's lots of things that could be kind of a what's next. I mean, Sunday teachings, you know, for anybody who's interested. I don't know how many of you have come to any Sunday teachings. Some have, but 10:30 on Sundays, and Geshe-la or Geshe Tsongpo usually do those, but some of our other Sangha do those as well. But those are usually lovely. Meditation 101, which these two run back to back. It's not going to start next week. It's not going to start until the week after, for anybody who's interested in that. We are going to have a...
What day is that going to be?
Next Tuesday's the 9th. What's the day after that? It will be on a Tuesday, thank you. It will be not next Tuesday, but the Tuesday after that. It's going to be on a Tuesday, whatever day it is. Guess the... With 16th, thank you. So it'll start then.
Same time,
7 o'clock, 7 to 8:30. There's always Discovering Buddhism. That's a little more of a commitment. And, I mean, I took that before I knew anything about Buddhism, and that, you know, that's how we kind of got in this field. Most people decide they're going to be a Buddhist, and then they take Discovering Buddhism, but you could take it either way, and it does go into a lot more detail. Especially if you're not sure if this is, you know, the path you want to follow. It's a commitment, but you'll learn more about this path to see if it really is what you want to do. The reading list you have that was on our website for this Buddhism in a Nutshell class, and you know, any book by His Holiness, and we have wonderful books out there that you can't go wrong. And then check our website. We have visiting teachers that are coming. Venerable Rabina's coming in March. I think Venerable Amy is coming in June. Lama Zopa Rinpoche will be here in August. And they do public teachings, and so there's all kinds of things that you should be able to attend. And if you've never seen a sand mandala made, Geshe Tsongpo is going to be doing one starting on February 9th at Meredith College. And he did one here at the center on the same mandala he's going to create there. It was quite lovely. He's very talented. The SPMT site is a wonderful resource. That's the foundation for the preservation of the Mahayana tradition. And they have things, prayers you can buy for a dollar, and you know, things that are free on there that you can get. So that's a great resource. Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archives, they have free books that are available. We have some out here. They're free. A donation is requested as you have the funds and the money to donate, but those books are quite good, and their website has a lot of information on it. We have great books out here. Sherry said last week nobody would be here to sell books, but we do. Suzanne came in tonight, so the bookstore is open. If any of you weren't able to purchase anything, you can. And remember that all of the teachings here are done on a donation basis. They're all done free of charge, and we just ask that you pay it forward so that other generations can keep coming and keep having these teachings, and you pay it back for all the people that gave so that we could have this incredible center here. So you can think about what you can give and what you're able to give. And then just thank you. I hope that if you heard anything from any of us who you know, gave you any wisdom or insight, that even little nuggets that would be of value to you and to others as you go through and you continue your studies. And so before you leave, are there any questions or comments before we end for the night?
I'd like to thank you for doing this class and putting up with my questions.
You're welcome. I loved your questions. I love everybody's questions. I know that even somebody made the comment about annoying with questions. It's never annoying. It doesn't mean I can answer it, but it's not ever annoying. So thank you for your questions. I appreciate that. And then I learn a lot from those. So shall we dedicate? Got to dedicate all this, right? This is a huge commitment. So you need to rejoice and dedicate. So go ahead and sit comfortably. And just think, that you made such a tremendous effort to get here. Believe me, I appreciate that from the bottom of my heart. And it's huge. I know how huge it is. Because I know the effort it takes. And you did that for a reason. And just being here and sitting in this gampa, huge, unbelievable merit. And I want you to think about all the merit that you had to create to find this center, to find this teaching, and to be in a position to do whatever it takes to come and listen. It's unbelievable, good karma. And if we dedicate that, we seal it so it doesn't ever get lost. It'll keep growing and growing. And we can make the aspiration that we continue to create good karma, to eliminate non-virtuous actions, so that we can keep on whatever path we choose. Doesn't matter. That's not even what's important. The only thing that matters is we keep a good heart and we practice loving kindness and compassion. And so dedicate that we can continue to do that for our own well-being and that of others. All right, you guys, I look forward to seeing you here sometime. Thank you very much.
Thank you.